Okay.
Well, my name is David Werdigo. On behalf of JBD, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's event. Special thank you to Ralph Brown, who's here, because it was actually his idea that we do some events in the city that also may qualify for CPD. So thanks for that inspiration, and we look forward to offering similar things in the future. So I'd like to introduce Justice Sifras. He was appointed to the Supreme Court of Victoria in 2010, currently sits in the Commercial Court. I wonder how many of you have been on the other side of the bar to His Honour and live to talk about it.
Thank God, no.
So he previously practiced in South Africa. While at the bar, he specialised in banking and finance law, corporations and insolvency law. He's acted for many leading financial institutions and retained in many of the high-profile corporate collapses, and recently appeared for ASIC. He's not going to talk about that today. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce His Honour, Justice Michael Sifras.
Thanks, David. Thanks for inviting me to speak. Well, I don't know if I can do it in half an hour. I've given a similar talk that went half a day, but I'll try and condense it down to a few basic propositions. The law is always concerned with balancing the rights of the parties. That's a critical function of the law. Any day of the week you can read the paper and you'll find situations that call for balancing the rights of the parties. So you look in the paper this morning, there were a number of things, but two that caught my eye. One, number plates, registration of number plates. Someone wanted a number plate, ICE, D-E-A-L-R, and he was knocked back. So does he have a right to have a personal number plate of his choosing, or is there a greater right that society has that someone not have that registration plate? It's a competition of rights. There was an American soldier who refused to swear an oath. He refused to swear by Almighty God that he will faithfully do what he is mandated to do. He's an atheist. He says, I have a right. I have a right to practice no religion at all. You can't compel me to swear an oath. Competition of rights. But rights change as well. And that's very important. The sperm donor a generation ago that donated sperm on the condition of anonymity has now had that anonymity removed. Why? Because there was a competing right. A right on the part of someone to know who their parents are, biological parents. So the right shifted. Today's 9/11. Since 9/11, there have been different rights. The rights of liberty and security. Liberty's been restricted in favour of security. So the law is concerned with balancing the rights of the parties, of individuals living in a society. Now let's become a little bit more focused on religion. So when it gets to the practice of religion, how much religious freedom do we have? How much religious freedom should we have? Does unrestricted and unrestrained religious freedom, can that undermine a civil society? Should you be allowed to slaughter a red heifer, Pariah Dumas, in the middle of Balaclava Road? Should a hand be chopped off outside a mosque in North Brunswick? So you can see that every day you have religious practices, and we all like to, different religions in our society, like to practice their religion as far as they can. But there are countervailing considerations associated with what we call a civil society. And how far can we go? And this confrontation between rights happens all the time in a whole range of different circumstances, and of course, including all different religions. So the Sephardi Jew that put up a sukkah in Montreal on his balcony was told to remove the sukkah. He said, well, I'm entitled to have a sukkah. It's sukkahs. I would have ordered him to remove it within 8 days. But, stayed the order for 8 days. But, so he was ordered by the body equivalent of the body corporate to remove the sukkah. Well, he said, "No, I'm an Orthodox Jew. I want a sukkah." And it went to the Supreme Court of Canada, right up to the Supreme Court of Canada. And Canada has a Bill of Rights, the relevance of that I'll tell you about later. And he said, "I'm entitled to practice religion." And they said, "No, because in the bylaws of the constitution of the body corporate, you can't have ornamental," whatever the wording was. Supreme Court, first judge said, "Body corporate is right." Court of Appeal in Canada, three judges said, "Body corporate is right." He had to remove the sukkah. Of course, he foreshadowed his intention to put up a sukkah, and then this all got to court very quickly. The Supreme Court of Canada, the highest court in the land, was divided 5-4, nine judges. Five judges said it was allowed and he should be permitted to put up the sukkah, and four said no. There was a similar case in Canada dealing with a Sikh boy who wanted to wear a turban in class. You can see that these situations happen all the time and across different religions. Shchita, Brit Milah. There have been all sorts of attempts to curtail the practice of religious freedom. So it begs the question, how much religious freedom do we have? So I'd like to start with a scenario and then try and answer the question as to how much religious freedom we have. So let's assume, and I've given this example before and some of you have heard it, just bear with me for a moment. The year is 2024 and the Greens are in power in Commonwealth and state. And their agenda is animal rights, children's rights, and conservation. So animal rights, shchit is banned. Children's rights, there's a ban on Brit Milah until the child's able to make a decision himself. And environmentally, let's take a complete hypothetical. You're not allowed to have a Shabbos clock. Or you're not allowed to have electricity on in the house if you're not in the house. You can't keep lights on. Some sort of energy preservation legislation. Can that be done? Legitimate question. Can legislation of that kind be passed, or are we protected? Now, of course, if legislation is passed to such effect and people are not happy, there's the political dimension. You can vote the government out and change legislation as being threatened to, has been done, as you've noticed in the Commonwealth and state as well. But can it be done? Is the legislation valid? That's a very important question. And the question, the framework for the question is, how far can we go as a religion? Let's talk about Jewish religion. And the flip side, how far can the state go and the Commonwealth in order to restrict our religious practices? That's the question. Now, how does one answer that question? I'll answer it in the following way, and I'll try and be brief. Generally, and we've all seen in the past, and we know, that countries have passed a whole range of legislation that affect human rights, the ability to practice religion and the like. The Nuremberg Laws. Laws in South Africa restricting blacks from inhabiting various areas, and a whole lot of apartheid legislation, which at the last count, when I was there recently and gave a lecture, there were 230 pieces of legislation directed to discrimination against indigenous people in South Africa. Those are all passed by a parliament, South African Parliament. Nobody suggested the laws were invalid. Does law have to have a minimum moral content to be a law? Well, generally, no. It's got to be passed in a particular way. If it's passed in a particular way, it's law. So can the government pass a law, a Good Samaritan law? You have to help your neighbour. and the government pass laws that bald people don't pay tax. I mean, you can think of the most absurd examples, but it does raise an interesting question. It'll be a stupid law, and the government will be voted out, but it's a law. It's passed in the required way. So I think it's good to start with the notion of parliamentary sovereignty. That means the starting point should be the government of the day can pass whatever law it wants, provided it does so in the right way and it follows the correct procedures. It's just, let's use that as a starting point. And then let's beg the question, what controls are there to abuse of this power? Now, to answer that, one has to look at the particular country, the particular constitutional framework. The law in Iran is different to the law in Israel, to the United Kingdom, the United States, Canada, Australia. What's different is the constitution and whether there's a Bill of Rights. That constitutes a very important dimension as to whether and control over whether legislation is valid or not. So let's look at some of those controls. So the first control is legislative power. So we start with the proposition, government can do what it wants. Next thing, let's look at what enables parliaments to pass laws. In the case of Australia, there's a constitution. The Commonwealth Constitution permits the Commonwealth to pass laws in relation to a number of defined categories. That's all. And then the states have what's called plenary power to pass whatever legislation it wants, provided it's not reserved to the Commonwealth. So if the Commonwealth purports to pass legislation outside of specific categories that it is empowered to pass under the Constitution, those laws will not be valid. So that's one control, where we can look at a law of the Commonwealth and say, well, is the Commonwealth entitled to pass that law? What head of power is it? Commonwealth's got various heads of powers, corporations, trade, defence, income tax, whatever it is. Does it fall within that? Yes. If it doesn't fall within that, there's often constitutional challenges because it doesn't fall within a head of power. The states are a little different because the states have got power, plenary power, to pass any legislation, provided it's not reserved to the Commonwealth. So how does one challenge a state law? Well, if it's passed in the required way, then there's very little challenge. There was a challenge very, very early on because the Constitution provides for the state of Victoria to pass laws for the good government or for the welfare of the people or some lovely term. And it was argued that that particular law wasn't for good governance or for the welfare of the people of Victoria. And that was rejected by the High Court very quickly. So really, the state constitution says nothing about legislative power, and therefore the Parliament of Victoria can pass whatever laws it wants to. Now let's look at other controls. So the enabling control, or that which is enables the Commonwealth and state to pass legislation, that doesn't help us at all. Bill of Rights. Those countries that have a Bill of Rights are far better protected, on one view, because a Bill of Rights is a pre-existing document by which legislation is measured. But there's a Bill of Rights providing for freedom to practice religion and a whole lot of other rights in the Bill of Rights, a right to have housing, affordable housing and the like. When legislation is passed, it has to be measured against this pre-existing document which sets out the rights of the citizens. And that's why in the states you have challenges to legislation all the time, because the challenges are you can't pass that law requiring compulsory busing or schooling because it's against this particular part of the Constitution. So we don't have that. We have constitutional challenges on the grounds that the legislation that's passed doesn't fall within a head of power. That's the usual challenge to the Commonwealth legislation. But we don't have a Bill of Rights. Countries that have a Bill of Rights, Canada, the USA, South Africa, you have a different framework, because when legislation is passed, people look at it and say, oh, well, well may you, Parliament, say that I have to do A, B, and C. That's very nice. But I have a right that you, the Parliament, comply with a pre-existing document called a Bill of Rights. And you haven't measured up to that, and I'm going to challenge that. So, going down the list of controls on legislative power in Australia, Constitution doesn't really help us. We don't have a Bill of Rights. We do in Victoria have a Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, which is, at best, it can be called an aspirational type document. Legislation should aspire to complying with the various rights and duties set out in this Charter. It's a very good document, it's a positive document, it's a positive step, but the courts are limited. If a matter comes before me and the issue is whether legislation is valid, you can't say the legislation's not valid because there's a provision in the Charter. All that a judge can do is make a declaration of incompatibility. It's saying, well, this legislation, it is valid, it's been passed properly, but really it's not compatible with this document called the Charter of Human Rights. And then it's a matter for the Attorney General and to take the matter up and perhaps change the law. That's the Bill of Rights. There's one further thing I want to say about the Constitution. Does the Constitution, well, let's look at the Commonwealth Constitution. There is a section in the Commonwealth Constitution, section 116, which prohibits the Commonwealth from establishing any religion. And there are two further provisions. I've got them in my notes, but once I look at my notes, we'll be here the whole day. There are two further. The government cannot compel by legislation someone to practice religion, and cannot compel by legislation someone to not practice their religion. So there is some scope of section 116, but it's been interpreted very, very narrowly. What is the laws for the establishment of a religion? Very narrow. The government's passed a number of laws over the years, and the courts, there's no court that's held that that legislation should be struck down as offending section 116. In the Second World War, there were conscientious objectors, Jehovah's Witnesses, that said, I have a right, it's in the Constitution, section 116, you can't force me. They said, that's nothing to do with religion, the security of the state, other matters. So section 116 only applies if the specific legislation is directed to prohibiting you from practicing your religion, compelling you to practice a religion, or establishing a religion. Otherwise, it has very limited application. So, what's the next control? The next control is international treaties. So we don't have a Bill of Rights. Commonwealth and state can sort of do what they want. I'm getting back to my animal rights and human rights, the Greenies, and trying to assess what controls we have. So there are international treaties, and if I've got them here, if I read them out, it'll take 20 minutes. There must be 20 or 25 treaties, and the object of all these international treaties is some are United Nations declarations and the like, Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. There are all sorts of conventions dealing with ability to practice religion, not to be discriminated against, and the like. What's the status of those treaties, doctrines, and declarations? Well, they are persuasive. That's the first point. No court and no government likes to ignore international treaties. If there's a treaty that's properly formulated, particularly if you've signed up to the treaty, it doesn't have the binding force of law, but a good comity among nations suggests that you you try and comply with the declaration or the treaty. In order for the treaty to apply in Australian law, it has to be incorporated into Australian law. Domestic law is called Australian law, by an act of parliament, and normally they're not. So it remains aspirational. That's the next sort of control. So then we're left with, finally, what I want to get to is what's called the common law, or the general law. There are two sources of law. One is legislation, government passes laws, and the other is the common law, law that's developed over the years, over the centuries, organically, through the courts primarily. What does that law say about the practice of religion, the right to practice religion and the like in its various manifestations? Well, the common law did not have a right to freedom of religion, and the common law respected parliamentary sovereignty. That means the law as it developed and judges regarded Parliament as being sovereign and Parliament having the ability to pass whatever laws it wants to. And you have a number of cases. I'll give you one. There was a case in South Australia where a Christian Brothers College said, well, we'll have our own syllabus, thank you very much. This was in the earlier days, in the 30s, I think it was, 40s. Grace and the Bible College, I think it was called, the case. But we'll have our own school, thank you, and we'll have our own syllabus. You can't tell us what to do, because one of the controls, under the general law, we're entitled to practice our religion. 3-0, the court said, no, you're not. The full court in South Australia said, you're not. The common law does not recognise freedom to practice religion. There's an Act of Parliament saying, an Education Act dealing with the syllabus and the like, you have to comply with it, that's it. So there's no common law right to freedom of religion, practice your religion. Let's look at some other aspects. The law as it has developed has regarded the practice of religion so far as it relates to the liturgy, religious practices, the hiring and subject to some exceptions and firing of rabbis, and generally the practice of religion as being the domain of the religion and its hierarchy, chief rabbi and the like. So the law has been, the common law I'm talking about, has been reluctant to interfere in that sphere of religious practice. So you have numerous examples of this in the UK. The chief rabbi, I don't know what defrocked or whatever the wording is, a rabbi of because he was having affairs with all his congregants. So the chief rabbi said, no, you can't do that, I'm sorry, it's not permissible, and he was I don't know whether his smicha was taken away, whatever, he wasn't permitted to be a congregational rabbi. And that was almost by edict of the chief rabbi. He took it to court, it's a reported decision. And the court said, we're not interfering, you're a rabbi, you're under the jurisdiction of the chief rabbi. And he said, well, I haven't been given a proper hearing, and I'm not sure about this, and not that woman, not a whole meister. Court said, not interested, you've got your own structures in place for determining these sorts of things, I'm not going to interfere, and indeed the court didn't. And there are numerous examples of this. In the Anglican Church in Sydney, there was a case, ordination of women, and it went to court, and the court said, we're not getting involved, it's a matter for the church, if you want to ordain women, you go ahead, otherwise we're not going to get involved, not an issue of discrimination and the like, it's your own religious practices, you've signed up to the religion, you're bound by what the religion says. Scarlett and Dowling, I think it was called. There have been cases involving the Macedonian and Serbian Orthodox churches. I had one before me where there was a big fight I was rung by the court coordinator asking if I could do a massive dispute between two communities. I asked if it was Jewish. She said no. I said fine. And then she said it was Serbian Macedonian. So I said fine. So that was a dispute. It was a terrible dispute, ugly dispute. There've been a number of disputes. My case was a little different. It involved trust property, so the court could get involved. But those that involve strict whether we're going to comply with this prayer book or that prayer book, or the order of service and liturgical type matters, the courts have said we're not getting involved. And there are numerous cases on that. The Baha'i, there was a case in New Zealand, a woman said, I'm entitled to be a member of the Baha'i community. They have a presence in New Zealand, they obviously have one in Israel, in Haifa, I think that's there. And the head of the community said no, because you don't adhere to the following tenets of the faith. And she said, I do, don't, that court said, we're not interested. There's been a decision made by your hierarchy, we're not getting involved. So there is some scope for us to practice those parts of our religion relating to liturgy and religious practices that courts will not get involved in.
What happens if it comes to violence?
I'll come to that later. So there are just two more topics that I want to deal with under this sort of heading of the general law. The next one is whether we have a right to determine our own disputes, refer a dispute to a Beth Din. So it's a complicated question, but the short answer is yes. The short answer is if you want a dispute determined by a Beth Din according to halakha, that can be done, but it has to be done properly. And it hasn't been done properly in a number of cases. The case of Engel and the Adelaide Hebrew congregation, the reference to the Sydney Beth Din and a number of other aspects did not make it clear that what the parties were agreeing to was a Din Torah according to Jewish law. If you have a document that is a reference to arbitration or a Beth Din, and it specifically says that the matter will be determined according to Jewish law and a few other safeguards that I won't go into now, then it must be done according to Jewish law. But in Mond and Caulfield, that wasn't done. And in the other case I referred to, it wasn't done. Where it's done properly, courts will not get involved. I found a decision of a in England where the judge. It's a very good decision. It's a matter of Schwebel and Schwebel, where the judge said the court could not entertain an appeal. It was an appeal from a Din Torah on a question of law, because it was clear from the arbitration agreement. There was the agreement to submit the matter to a Din Torah. It was clear from the arbitration agreement that the arbitrators had applied Jewish law, they were bound to apply Jewish law, and the court could not be expected to determine whether the Beth Din had been wrong as a matter of Jewish law. So a proper submission having the matter determined according to Jewish law is valid if it's done properly. Final matter I want to raise is the matter of discrimination. It operates on two levels. The first level is, as a community, we have a right not to be discriminated against. And the second part of that, the flip side, is we have a right to discriminate. So we can have an Orthodox school, we can hire our own teachers, and we can discriminate against people under the exemption provided for in the Equal Opportunities Act. There's an exemption specifically relating to religious practices and the like. The first one, we can't be discriminated against. Numerous cases. There was a case of Azrael in New South Wales. He wanted public housing and he wanted a courtyard so he can put a sukkah, and he wanted to be near the shul, and he had all sorts of requests. He was knocked back and the court said he shouldn't have been knocked back. Because we'll be discriminating against him. It's an interesting decision. Went to the Court of Appeal, in fact. But more importantly is the right for us to discriminate, because those of us that want to practice our religion properly and in this balancing exercise, others may think we're discriminating, and I should have prefaced this whole series by saying that anything that I say today represents my own views and not the views of the court. But in order to practice your religion, others may think it involves a degree of discrimination. That exemption is specifically provided for in the Equal Opportunity Act. Now, it's a very difficult, and as I started, I said values shift and balances shift, and I think there is now a shift away from that exemption, and I'll read to you two pieces of that very, very, very quickly and very shortly. But it is a difficult balance, because if you remove the exemption, religions will suffer. People will say, well, I can't practice my religion. Of course I have to. I can't employ a woman teaching an all-male school, or I can't do this, or whatever the alleged discrimination act is. You can't eliminate it entirely, and you can't give complete control, because you'll have hands being cut off. So there has to be a balance, and the balance can shift. And I detect that so far as the religious exemption is concerned, there is a bit of a shift away from the previous tolerance and the previous, I think the exemption's been construed very well and quite broadly, enabling schools to do certain things and enabling what would otherwise be discrimination in the practice of our religion. But there was a case recently where I can't remember exactly who the parties were, but I think it was it might have been a church organisation. There was a landlord. It doesn't matter if I've got this part wrong. There was a landlord that was committed to I think Catholicism, and refused to permit a group that was intending to run a seminar on the weekend at a campsite to permit that organisation to hire out the campsite, because they were promoting same-sex relationships. And they said, well, it's our religion, it's part of our religion, we think it's wrong. We want to practice our religion. We don't want to rent this out to these people for the weekend. Case went to court, went to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal 2-1, and you can see how these things can often be very personal. Court 2-1 said it is discrimination because being a landlord's got nothing to do with your with your religion, and you'd rent it out to someone, you're discriminating. And the one judge said no. Because it was part and parcel of their whole religion that they were against whatever the camp was trying to do. Law Institute, in the Law Institute, which a number of you will have got, the latest edition, there's a letter saying congratulations to the Law Institute and its president in opposing elements of the religious exemptions under the Equal Opportunity Act. The Law Institute has called for a more considered approach to the religious exemptions under the Equal Opportunity Act. These currently allow religious bodies and schools, at the same time as receiving government funding, to discriminate on the basis of a person's religious belief, sexual orientation, etc. And the suggestion in this letter is that that be wound back, and that the Law Institute is correct in winding back, in endeavouring to wind back those exemptions. So time is getting on. I'll just conclude by saying this. Where are we and how good are our controls? And I'll say this, that whether you're a member of ADAS or whether you're a member of the temple, we really have little room for complaint at the moment. But if the Greens got in 2014, we might have grounds for complaint. But we do have a large measure of autonomy. We have a right not to be vilified. Ritual and spiritual and related matters are within our own control. The discrimination exemption works well for us in the sense of we can't be discriminated against, and we can discriminate. And we can use Jewish law to resolve disputes if it's done properly. But the message I leave you with is that there are no guarantees, because we have a weak constitution, we don't have a Bill of Rights, and we're bound by parliamentary sovereignty. So the price of religious freedom is eternal vigilance. So, question on violence. So what's the exact question?
I came in the middle. You're talking about the autonomy of religious courts. So, allowing them to go down their own pathway, in some cultures, it leads to them administering their own sort of form of punishment, which can actually, in certain cases, be violent.
Yes. Yeah, no, well, that wouldn't be permitted. So I think you have to comply with the law. What I didn't say, which a quick review of my notes suggested, was that religious practice is against the law, for example, you've got to obey the law. So the law says you can't assault someone. It would be an assault. You can't hide behind an assault by saying, oh, well, I had to give him 39 lashes, or I had to cut off his hand because that's my religion, and you've said that I can determine my own dispute. It's mainly civil disputes. When it gets to punishment and the like, then that's different. There is, in some countries, including our own, there are areas of law that are reserved for communities like. There is customary law, Aboriginal customary law, where there's spearing, and so there are certain mild exemptions. In South Africa, there was as well, but certainly not cutting off hands and the like.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
You mentioned before if a dispute is referred to a beis din, and the arbitration agreement clearly specifies that it will be determined according to Jewish law, and the courts will not get involved. Would you say that with any reservation? For example...
The answer is yes.
For example, according to my understanding, the Commercial Act stipulates that if an award has been given, an appeal cannot be made based on error in the understanding
law.
Of the law.
Yes.
Okay, so let's say the arbitration agreement stipulates it's going to follow the Jewish law. Jewish law stipulates that if the beis din recognizes a mistake, they have the right to change the verdict. Would the person winning the original outcome be able to appeal the change of judgment of the beis din, based on the fact that it's subject to the Arbitration Act, the Commercial Act, which does not allow a change based on mistaken law?
Yeah. Oh, look, that's an excellent question. I think a judge would direct them to go the beis din to reconvene in order to reconsider its own decision based on the error. If they didn't, I think that would be an error of law itself. That might be an error of law itself in Jewish law.
No, in other words, the beis din wanted to change. The beis din actually changed the law.
Yes.
So the person says you can't change. Huh?
The award.
The beis din changes, and the person that suffered from the change appeals it and says, no, the Commercial Act does not allow you to change the law. So would the court respect the change, or would they not respect the change?
Or respect the change.
They would respect the change.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
Well, following on.
But let me just answer another part before I forget. That's an interesting question, but the two other related interesting questions are, even though there's an arbitration agreement that expressly provides for Jewish law to apply, is that only Jewish law, substantive law, the halakha dealing with a particular topic, or is it procedural as well? So that's another point that hasn't quite been determined. In other words, if the Beth Din get together, and they say, we're not interested in hearing from you, we'll determine it according to Jewish law, and Jewish law is that we don't have to hear from you. Now, secular law says you've got to hear from all parties. It's a fundamental right that you have, the right to be heard. And if and we're not interested in hearing from you. Now, even though that's embraced in, if that in, is indeed halakha, it may or may not be, but if it is, can you appeal that on the grounds that that's not the substantive law, but it's a procedural matter? That's a different analysis.
Although the best in, as the arbitrators, they've got the right to set their own procedure, and they say, can I?
And that might be part of substantive law,
well, that's what I'm
the ability to set their own procedures. So we're in grey area.
Can I just ask a follow-on question then? Bearing in mind that the substantive law is halacha, the best in issues an award. Part of the substantive law of halacha is that a best in can exercise social controls over the participants in order to make that to make it valid.
Like a chayrim.
That's right.
Yes, yes.
So can the Bezdin then say if you don't follow, if you don't, you know, pay X dollars or whatever for the award, we will put you in chayrim.
Yes.
Which has an economic disadvantage to the losing party. Can the losing party then go to the court and say, I am being discriminated against under the law, but the substantive law allows the Beth Din to do that. And I'm not saying that the court should say we will maintain the chayrim, because a court will not do that, but we're saying, will the court interfere with the social control?
No. There's a case in South Africa, Taylor and Kudstak. Rabbi Kudstak was head of the Beth Din. Taylor was ordered to pay maintenance to his wife, ex-wife. He didn't. Chayrim put on him, and he appealed to the court. The court said, see you later, as they said in the case of the rabbi who was defrocked. Your internal procedures, your own hierarchy, your own rabbis determined that the price for not complying with the order is...
Even though it has economic consequences, which under normal circumstances would be discrimination under...
Well, it had economic consequences. He was enriched to the extent that he didn't have to pay maintenance. Positive consequences. David, you want to ask a question?
No, there was a case in Sydney, Amzalek and Konstopolsky, where a Beth Din verdict was set aside for what looked to be procedural issues.
Amzalek, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So the two caveats I had on one was the procedural issues, and the other one was what happens before you get to the agreement. Because as the lawyers here will know, often you say, well, yes, there is an agreement, but there was duress or undue influence. So the steps leading up to the formation of that agreement, would that be governed by secular law or not? It probably would. That's another grey area.
Because it's an arbitration agreement that is the overarching agreement that enables...
That's right. Yes, that's right. Well, I hope that gives you sort of something to think about.
Justice Sifris, on behalf of everybody here today, I'd like to thank you for a really insightful and above all relevant discussion. And I can honestly say confidently that it's been our joy and privilege to be with you today to hear you talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks.